there's new data published today in PNAS that the genetic variance of this delta 6 desaturase gene and the ability of EPA of this conversion to occur interacts with breastfeeding to determine IQ in children. So if you're not breastfeeding and not giving your baby DHA and you have a poor genetic variant, your child has significantly lower IQ. Thus its importance in brain development. You can also overwhelm this and sort of instead of genetically, if you're predisposed to poor conversion, you can load your body up with lots of linoleic acid, which also competes with the enzyme, and there you get this great amount of arachidonic acid produced, 20 carbons, 4 unsaturates, and then when they get digested, they make these pro-inflammatory leukotrienes and eicosanoids. So when you think about what your tissue is loaded up with here, you have to think about not only how much arachidonic EPA and DHA you're eating, but what's the background, especially of linoleic acid that you're eating. So here is, I like it when other people show old data. So here's old data from 1963 from Ralph Holman in rats looking at this linoleic acid here at 0.5% up to 10% in the diet. And even though they're eating the same amounts of fish, here going from 0.5% where we started at the beginning of the 20th century up to about 10% of calories, the DHA drops by more than half. And the EPA drops from more than 4% to, you know, less than 0.5%. So just by loading the diet up with linoleic acid, we've been able to lower the tissue levels of the really important omega-3 fatty acids. So in this complex slide, which is published in here, we look at the tissue target of being a Japanese old guy. Now, if you're in the Philippines and you want 60%, your background linoleic acid is 0.8% of your calories. Okay? So there's the linolenic, there's the arachidonic, which is pretty much the same across countries. So in this case, in the Philippines, you only need about 0.1 or 275 milligrams per day of EPA and DHA to get the amounts of EPA and DHA you want in your tissues. Now say you live in Denmark and instead of 0.8, you're up to 2%. Then you need 1,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA. Say you live in the UK and you're at about 4%, to get to that same tissue target level, you need 1.5 grams of EPA and DHA. But here in the US, where 9 or 10% of our calories come from linoleic acid, you need 3.6 grams per day of EPA and DHA to get your same tissue compositions and your same reduction in cardiovascular risk. Okay, so here we are looking at the diversity of LA across countries currently existing, 0.8, which probably better reflects evolution, up to 9%, increasing the dietary requirement of EPA and DHA more than tenfold, about 13-fold, to get the same tissue levels and the same disease risk. So dietary intakes of long-chain omega-3 fatty acids vary more than tenfold necessary to achieve Japanese tissue levels, 98% protection. This variation is due to greater background levels of linoleic acid intake, and lowering linoleic acid intakes could do lots of things and include reduce the burdens of fisheries and reduce the burden of production of EPA and DHA. Now, why is this a big deal? I tried my best to get estimates of about 387 different foods consumed in the U.S. every year from 1909 to 1999. These are not perfectly adjusted for declining nutrient contents in each of those foods, but we did the best that we could. So the big deal change from 1900 to 2000 in the U.S. diet is this. It's not so big in fats. It's not so big in carbohydrates. This is the food commodity that's changed, soybean oil. And it goes from almost non-existence in the U.S. diet in 1900 to almost 12 kilograms per person per year. Here is canola oil, and it's only 1 kilogram per person per year. And nothing else even comes close for that change in dietary intakes. So why is this a big deal? It's a big deal because about half of soybean oil is linoleic acid. It is this omega-6 fatty acid. So being a guy that likes to reduce homicide and think about things, I did a thought experiment to then say, okay, we have data that omega-3s reduce suicide, homicide, and violence. Do omega-6s potentially increase it? So here's data from the U.S. from 1950 to 2000, looking at an increase in linoleic acid in the food supply, which correlates fairly well to increased rates of homicide mortality in the U.S., but there's many things that can cause this. It's only correlational. So I looked at other countries to see if the same phenomenon was occurring. And here's data in the UK, which has a very different increase in omega-6s, from 1% here in 1961 to about 5% in 2000. The correlation coefficients are quite good, unlikely to be due to chance. And again, correlating with about a fourfold increase in the risk of homicide mortality. And then when I put the UK, this is across countries and across time at the same time, 1961 to 2000, Canada 61 to 2000, Australia, Argentina, the US. And using curve fitting data, the increased diversity of linoleic acid across countries correlates to about a 100-fold increased risk of homicide mortality in the US. So conversely, when we look to see if omega-3s appear to be ecologically associated with reduced risk, yes, again, it's about a 30-fold reduction in risk looking across countries with greater seafood consumption producing less homicide. And then we've already moved on to looking directly in interventional trials. Here's an observational trial with polysubstance abusers. Those who have a history of assaults don't eat fish. Those who have no history of assaults eat much more fish. And here, in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial of violent prisoners, Bernard Gesch gave essential fatty acids plus minerals and vitamins for 6 months, 9 months, and found a 37% reduction in felony-level violence among prisoners. So I want to thank you and consider that although I'm showing you the far extreme of pathology in the brain caused by a nutritional deficiency, I think that it affects all levels of emotion. And we even have data showing that lower tissue levels of omega-3s increase neuroticism and increase disagreeableness. And I hope you found my talk agreeable.
On August 29, 2005, Hurricane Katrina struck the city of New Orleans, breaching the levees that kept the city dry. The resulting floodwaters inundated the majority of the city, resulting in over 1,000 casualties and billions of dollars of damage. Less than a month later, Hurricane Rita passed over the city, reflooding many of the same neighborhoods. The floodwaters washed through many of the areas of the city with known toxic hazards, shown here on this map with circles and triangles. The blue area of this map shows the area of the city that was inundated by the floods. Many of these areas with toxic hazards were located adjacent to residential communities. A survey conducted in 2000 found that over three-quarters of the public housing projects were located within 1 mile of one or more toxic dumps. The floodwaters also swept through areas of the city where the soils had been heavily contaminated from previous industrial or waste disposal activities. Examples include a former pesticide blending and storage facility, shown here in the top right photo, where an estimated 2,600 tons of herbicide-contaminated soil was covered with six feet of water. The Agricultural Street landfill, a federally designated Superfund site, was also flooded, along with the public housing project constructed on top of it. Both of these sites have been the focus of long-standing community campaigns for cleanup. Additionally, many of the residential areas that were flooded were well known to contain lead-contaminated soils from the use of leaded gasoline and lead in paints. Spills of fuels, industrial chemicals, and sewage also contaminated the floodwaters. When the water finally receded, the city was covered in a layer of sediment inches deep in some areas, left behind by the floodwaters. In some areas, the sediment was stained a dark color, as in these photos with obvious fuel contamination. In other areas, the risks were not so clear. In our ongoing conversations with local community groups and activists following the storm, many residents raised concerns about contamination and potential health risks from exposure to these sediments. The US EPA, in partnership with the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, took samples of the sediment from all over the city and analyzed them for both organic and inorganic contaminants. However, the results of the sampling were not made available in a form that was helpful for answering the community's questions. The Natural Resources Defense Council scientists were able to fill this gap, conducting an independent analysis of EPA's data to evaluate the extent of contamination. As expected, there was widespread contamination of the soils with hydrocarbons resulting from the many fuel and oil spills. Also not surprisingly, areas of the older parts of the city had pockets of lead-contaminated sediment. What was surprising was the US EPA testing also uncovered elevated levels of arsenic. In fact, according to our analysis of EPA's data, 30% of the sediment sampled from the Greater New Orleans area exceeded, in the months right following the storm, had elevated levels of arsenic, shown here on the map with red dots. These samples exceeded the state of Louisiana's cleanup level for arsenic in residential soils, which is 12 milligrams per kilogram. For comparison, the US EPA Region 6 Soil Screening Guidelines for arsenic in residential soils is 0.39 milligrams per kilogram. In January of 2006, the US EPA and the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality declared that there were no elevated health risks associated with the sediment left by the flooding and attributed the elevated arsenic level.